Accession number 16808, rule 33.
Red Spittle's rule 33.
Yes, so contrary to what all our publicity at home had been, it seems that the damage wasn't all that great. The tragedy being these 2,000 women prisoners who were basically all drowned, I suppose. But anyway, those are the sort of things we used to do with Mr. Lieutenant Wolf and myself, these places we used to go to. And we went round to Heidelberg. We had a browse round there and saw various places, because he knew, being a German himself, he knew the places that where you really wanted to go and see and all that. And we went to Solingen, where the all the best steel comes from. We were in that area, and he said, well, we have to go there, he said. And we went there, and of course, they wanted to present us. They always have to give you gifts, you see, visitors, and they wanted to give us something. And I thought, well, I don't want anything, really, because I've got to carry it about. And so I settled for a little fruit knife, normally a little knife with a bone handle, which the Germans always used to seem to like, bone handles, and in a little case and everything. And which I brought home, it was a nice little thing. Unfortunately, the wife managed to lose it for me when we were out fishing once, and we was at the family of us were out, and there were some stinging nettles and that. And she thought she'd chop a few of these stinging nettles down with this little fruit knife. And I think one of the stinging nettles caught her hand, and she flicked the knife, and we never did find it. So that was my souvenir gone for the Burton. But and then we went to another place, and he got talking. I forget where the place was, but they had confiscated all the cameras and binoculars and things like that. And they were all in store in like the town hall, as we call it. And we went round there, and old Wolfie sorted himself a good old camera out there, one of these German Leica cameras with so many lenses in it and all God knows what. And, you know, so we used to do all these things, go around these places. And eventually, when we were going to leave this American camp, it rather comical because he got the new place where we've got to go to, and it was anyway, we've got to go right back up country because we've got to go through Bremen. And he said, well, you get the route. I said yes, so I went and see the American equivalent to our Red Caps and got the route out. And I thought, well, it's worth plenty of petrol. Because, I mean, it was only a 10 horsepower car, so it hadn't got a big tank, so you generally needed to carry spare petrol. So I goes up to fill up with petrol, and when I got there was this big line of American trucks, these big trucks, like cattle trucks. I thought, God, if I'm behind this lot, never get filled up. So I just drove up, straight up to the top of it, to the end of the column. There was this big American sergeant with a baton, and he got stripes up and down both sides of his arm. And these Yank drivers and that, they were hollering, and as I was driving by, they were shouting to me, because I was obviously pinching in, as it were, like. And when I gets right to the top, this sergeant, he said, hey, he said, what are you after, you know? And I said, can you get me filled up with petrol, Sarge? So he said, yeah, okay, he said. These American lorry drivers, they was all shouting and hollering, all back chat like they do, the Americans. They seem to always have to do that, like shout and holler at each other, like, whereas being British drivers, they'd have probably had a moan, but they just sat there and moaned and looked miserable. But not the Yanks, they seem as though they enjoy shouting insults to each other. And anyway, he's got me there, and I filled the car up. I said, I really need two or three jerry cans. I said, spare petrol, I said, because we've got a way to go. He said, okay, he said, okay. So he went over to one of these trucks and started taking jerry cans off of it. The bloke went berserk, he's pinching his jerry cans. He said, oh, get the hell out of it, he said. So, he said, that okay? So I said, yeah, that's okay. He said, okay, best of luck, you desert guys. He said, you got to look out of your desert guys. So I heard someone was there. I never knew me name. They just called me that desert guy. And so, of course, I went to Wolf, and off we went. And I always remember when we went to Bremen, it was amazing because the 51st Highland Division that was their headquarters, the divisional headquarters at Bremen. And they used to put on what in army terms was a bullshit guard parade every day. And we arrived in Bremen right in the middle of it. And we drove in, and the streets were crowded. I thought, Christ, I wonder what's happened here. Something spectacular, obviously. So anyway, we got it and got to a point where we could see what was expected to happen. And then suddenly we heard this pipe band. And honestly, my dear, standing on the back of your neck, there was this full pipe band. There must have been 100 pipers and drums and all that. And they were coming up all in the kilt and the pipe clay and everything. And what they used to do, they used to change this guard every day. And it was only a day guard, as we used to call it. In our mob, we used to have the day guards. And they were only just for show, really. They weren't really for guard purposes, they were for show. And they used to march the new guard up, you see, with a full pipe band. And the old guard would be there, and they used to change them over and everything. But we only saw the band. We didn't see the finish of it. We just see the pipe band marching past, you see. And but as they were caught there, the old kilts were swinging, the old pipes were playing and all that. And this Scots lad in the front got his old mace and that, you know, keeping it on and all that. And he got there and he got to a point, and it was obviously a tradition at this point, because all the people had been cheering and shouting and hollering while this, and then suddenly he stood up in front, he put this mace head in front of him, held it up with two hands, and they went dead. You couldn't imagine the silence as soon as he'd done it. And he put his hand underneath, and all of a sudden he let go of the zeppelin, it went up in the air, turned over and over and over in this dead silence. You couldn't believe it. And as he caught it, the crowd and the band started, and the crowd erupted. You've never heard such noise. But as soon as he put it up in the air, the band went silent and the crowd went silent. There was not a sound, and up it went. And I thought, Christ, if he missed it. But he obviously never did. And oh, it's a wonderful thing. And then just after that, we came back to Brussels because Wolfie felt we ought to have some leave, you see, because we'd never been back all this time. So we came back to Brussels, and I took the car around the garage, and we'd done a bit of service on that. And we was there for about a week or 10 days. And I got into friends with boxers and the boys and that, you know, and see all my friends and everything. And then we went back to Esselhide again. They said where we was going to work in the district, we were going to use Esselhide again. So we went back up to there, you see. And it was very devious, old Wolfie, at getting things done, because I didn't know nothing about him other than what he'd casually told me in a conversation about his family being at London and that. And I'd never seen a photo. He never showed me any photos. And then suddenly he says, we're going to Berlin. So I said, oh, what have we got to do there? He said, well, we've got to do nothing. He said, but I want to find my mother and father. And because they were still there, you see, because they'd become naturalised, but they were still in Germany, in Berlin. And they lived in the Charlottenburg area, apparently. Anyway, we get a pass. I've still got mine. We went twice, actually. I've still got my two passes upstairs in the scrapbook. And we couldn't do it in a day. Obviously, it was too far. So we stayed overnight at Belsen, at the camp. Of course, it was all tidied up. There was nothing horror about it when we got there. And it was an amazing camp, because UNRWA were in charge, and their headquarters was at Bergen, a village just down the road. And anyway, we went to there first, you see, to notify them we were there and we were going to stay the night and then go on again the next day. And it was a self-contained little town, the camp. They got a cinema in there and everything. And my recollection is, as we drove in from Bergen, we went in these, where the train went in, and there was a single train line down the left-hand side of the road, and all the way down each side of the road were these round holes. And I saw the machine. They got a machine like a big wood screw. And it went round, dug these holes out to whatever depth they wanted for sentries to stand in, like, you know, for defence and things like that. Just dug a hole, just like digging a hole in a piece of wood in the ground, down each side of the road. And then there was the road, trees each side, and this single railway track running down the side of the road until it got to the camp. Then there was the proper gates, and you went in the gates, and of course the train line went straight through and out the other side, through a thick belt of trees. They were that thick that when you went through from one side to the other, it was like going in a tunnel. They were that thick, these big trees, about 50 yards through from one side to the other. And my recollection is, as you went in these gates, on the right were like a little estate of houses and bungalows. And at the time we were there, the trees were all in blossom. It was beautiful. And on the left-hand side were these barrack blocks going up a slope, one behind the other. There was about four of them. And they were being used for various things, like medical staff, administration staff, guards, because they had still got sentries. The British Army was still there. And I think it was the Service Corps people, the personnel there were Service Corps, I believe. And so they got one of these barrack blocks to live in, you see. And there was a cinema in there and everything. And then, of course, there were people who were recuperating. And one wing was a hospital. And a lot of them were fully fit, as you might say, apart from the fact of what they'd lived through. You know, they weren't invalids anymore. They were there really waiting for disposal, I would think, although they'd still got one as a hospital with people in it. And when you went through this tunnel, as you might say, to the other side, there was about five big mounds. And the best description I can say is, in the old days, the farmers used to prepare the potatoes for winter by putting them in cloches. Like, they'd dig a trench, put all the potatoes in, straw and all that, and then they'd put the soil back on, and then they'd build them up in a long line, like an upside down trench. And the sides were sloped and the ends were sloped and the top was flat. And as long as they needed, that was the length of it, of course. And there was about five of these beside each other. And of course all the huts and everything had all long since gone, you see. And these were what they'd put all the bodies in or whatever to tidy the area up. And at the end of each one was simply a plain wooden cross. And on it would be what they thought were the nationality and the number of people in each one of these things, thousands and thousands of them. And the grass had just started to grow and cover it, so it wasn't dirt, it was all green grass, like new grass, or, you know. And that was what was the other side of the thing. And then there was another gate the other side, which I could see from a distance, which I never went to, like. But that was my impression of Belsen Camp. Well, we stayed there that night, and the next day we went on to Berlin. And it was the first time it happened. And the Russians, of course, were still in control, and the British hadn't got a garrison the first time we went. They got a sort of an attaché there, but no garrison troops as such. And when we was going in, we was following in a convoy of Russian lorries and things like that. And where the road was disrupted, they built a makeshift bridge at the side. And I could never understand it, because when they built it, instead of putting the planks across so that the members underneath went forward in front of you with the timber across the top left to right, they were the other way round. They were laying long ways. And a disaster happened for me, because I was following this big Russian truck, and I got another one behind me, and I could see it happening, and I couldn't do nothing about it. But as this lorry obviously went off the end of one of these long planks, this end, where I was just going over, came up, and I put a bit of a spurt on, because I knew it was underneath me, and I had visions of it coming through the floor. And I put a spurt on, and I thought I'd cleared it, and I just felt the click and the shudder, as I thought, it's just caught me, and I thought, I bet it's took me mudguard or me bumper off the back, you know. But he hadn't. What he'd done, because we went on, and we carried our motor, you see, and then we got out of this convoy, back onto the road, and suddenly the old engine conked out, and I thought, Christ, what's happened there? Run out of petrol. And what had happened, this end of this long plank had clipped the side of the petrol tank underneath, and of course I was lost on with petrol, but it was just enough below the split, probably about 1.5 inches, to keep enough petrol for me to go a mile or two after I got back on the road. So I was isolated from the convoy when I packed up, you see, and had to stop. And I thought, Christ, what are we going to do about that, you see? Well, the only thing is, I thought, well, I could stuff it with rag and got a bit of wood and stuff, you know, and tried to jam the hole up best I could, make it solid, but then I've got to get some petrol. And the funny thing happened then, because whether it's true or not, I can only take Lieutenant Wolf's word for it, but a big Russian staff car came down with these flags on all of the side, and he stopped. And the bloke got out, and it was obviously a big bloke, got all braid and stuff over him. And he wasn't a very big man, but he was very solid looking. And he got his peaked cap on, and he came and spoke, and him and Wolfie spoke to each other. And anyway, the outcome of it was the chauffeur got out, and he got a spare jerry can from out in the back of his this big staff car. And he gave us it, you see. So we were able to top up and fill up with that. And I'd still got a leak, but I'd bung the hole up pretty good, you know, so I knew we could go a good long way on this gallon, on this jerry can full of petrol. And I could see Wolfie was all excited, you see, and I thought, well, I wasn't excited, I was just bloody pleased we got a jerry can full off of a Russian staff car. But he said it was Khrushchev, the Russian general, who was in Berlin.
Zhukov?
Zhukov. He said that's who it was at the time. And seeing photo, my recollection, it could well have been, but I couldn't swear to it. But that's who Wolfie said it was, you know. I knew it was something different, because Wolfie was that excited, you know, he used to get excited sometimes. And that's who he said it was, Zhukov. Anyway, it got us into Berlin, and we went round to this big garage, which was still intact in Brussels, in Berlin, while Wolfie was doing his business, you see. He reported to the attaché there, the military establishment. And it's funny how the Germans still had this idea that when the Germans packed up, we ought not to have packed up. We should have carried on with the Germans, rearmed them, and carried on against Russia. They were obsessed with it. All the Germans you spoke to, they all said, you should carry on and finish what the Germans started against Russia. And I was all of the same opinion, that in a few years' time, Russia will be your enemy. Well, of course, it turned out it was, in a way, with the Cold War and everything. But, of course, you weren't thinking that at the time. And I went round this garage, and they put a new petrol tank in, you see. And I was talking to the boss there. He speak good English. I suppose he was educated, like, you know, a bit above normal class. And we were talking about things generally and that. And he said, come and have a look here, he said. So he took me round the back of the garage, and there was a big vehicle there, sheeted up. So we got this, dragged this sheet off of it, and it was one of these big black German cars that they used to have, with double wheels at the back. And it got a big mudguards with a seat that could be pulled down for 8 riders, and a pillar to put the machine gun on when they were travelling. And he said, what do you think of that? And the smell of the leather upholstery was overpowering when you got in it. And God, it was a massive thing, like a little charabang it was. And he said, now, who do you think it is? Well, I've got no idea, had I? He said, that's Admiral Dönitz's personal car. And that's who it was, Admiral Dönitz, who signed the surrender, who took the surrender over. It was his staff car that was in this garage in Berlin. And whatever happened to it, I don't know, but he got it sheeted up. Obviously, he was thinking he was going to get away with it, because there was such chaos. I mean, Dönitz wasn't going to worry about a staff car, was he, where he was going? And I reckon this garage bloke thought, you know, he got it and he was going to keep it, you know, for later on. He was obviously going to be worth some money to somebody. And that's who it was, Admiral Dönitz's staff car. But anyway, the Russians were friendly, of course. I mean, we could go anywhere in the city where there was a road open, you see, because the city was in such a shambles that they'd bulldozed certain roads to create movement all over the city, you see, but only in the major places, you see. And the thing that struck me, and again, I wish I'd had a camera. I don't know whether Wolfie took any photos. If he did, he never offered me any or said anything about it. But on most of the major junctions, they got a turret of a tank. And the amazing thing was, some of these were turrets or for Churchill tanks from Dieppe Raid that were in Berlin, and they were set in concrete with a motor for Travis to cover major points in the city for defence, with the guns on for Travis in these turrets, and on all these corners in Berlin. It's amazing. And another thing, when we was going to go down, we've got to go through the Brandenburg Gate to get to Charlottenburg, which was in the Russian sector later. We passed the Tiergartens, as they call it, and all the trees were shattered, shot off with a blast, and, like, you know, so you got all the tree stumps. And right in the middle of it was a First World War British tank as a museum piece. I mean, at Northampton, after the First World War, we had one in Northampton, Abingdon Park, a First World War tank. It was taken away for scrap during the war. And there in the Tiergarten was this First World War British tank on a little concrete plinth, standing there, what they'd obviously set up, you know. And then we went through the Brandenburg Gate to the Charlottenburg area. He seemed to know where we were going. And we came to one of those places which are peculiar to films, where you're going along a street and there's these houses and they've got these sort of pointed domes and things on them, like Russian style, really. And then you come to a big gates built over the top. And you open them and you go into a quadrangle. And all round it is the houses, like similar to the racing stables, where you go in and there's all the stables all round. But these were all flats, like units. And a balcony all the way around, because they're like ground floor and first floor, and then a balcony all the way around. Same as what we're building now with these blocks of flats in the towns. And so a block communal, really. And his mother was there. And anyway, he went off, and I stayed with the car, and he came back. And it was the only time I ever felt any sympathy to him, because he was upset. And his father had died, and his mother had remarried, and he didn't know. It had no correspondence of any sort, you know, since before the war. And it really upset him, because he obviously felt more affection for his father than he did his mother. That's the impression I got. But anyway, the outcome of it was I was taken in and introduced to his mother and his father-in-law, and little stepfather. And he gave me some trinkets, because everybody was doing everything that they could, as I told you before, barter was the way of life. And he got this Perspex, which they got off of bombers and things like that. And they'd been given away in the family to the children. It's a pity, I should have really liked to have kept one. And there was two pieces, you see, and inside he got these flower, like pressed flower, compressed flowers. And you could put photos in, you see, and then you put the two together and the hole drilled in, and they could be heart shaped or shaped like an animal. And inside was this thing, and it had two colours. Sometimes it would be blue and sometimes it would be red or whatever, you see. And they were lovely little ornamental things, and he was used to make these, and that was part of his way of scraping a living, by trading them, like, for whatever he could trade them for, like, you know. Anyway, that was the reason we'd gone to Berlin, was to find out about his mum and dad. And that's what we found, that his mum was alive, but his dad had passed away and she had remarried. And it shows you the German character, because we stayed there for about a week and then we came back. Stayed at Belsen on the way back, you see, because we had to break our journey twice, you know, each way, once each way. Then we came back to Esselheid. And he got on the trip there, and we went back to Berlin, Brussels. From there, went back to Brussels on the pretext of his time we had another break. But he only wanted to get out of some intelligence somewhere, and some authority, British Red Cross and people like that, you see. And he told me then that his idea was he wanted to get his mother out, back to Britain, you see. I said, you reckon you'll get them both out? So he said, no, only my mother. Now that was the German him in. Her husband was left behind for later on or whatever. As far as Wolfie was concerned, he didn't know him. It was his mother. You know, I mean, a bit of British, you might not have liked it, but you would have had accepted that his mother was married again. But not Wolfie. He was a stranger. He only wanted his mother. Anyway, we came back to Brussels and we got this arranged. And then I got the pass, the second one, so I can get the time. I couldn't tell you offhand what the months were. But it was only about a month or so later, and we went back in again. Same procedure, stayed at Belsen, and into Berlin, and was there for another week, got everything organised, and through UNRWA and the Red Cross. And his mother, by the time I left him to be demobbed, his mother had arrived in London. They got her to London. And when we got there, we'd been there at least one day, it might have been 2 days, and he said that your regiment's garrisoned here now, your 1st Royal Tank Regiment. Oh, I said, are they? He said, yes, he said, they came in the other day. So I missed that. And they were at Spandau Barracks on the outskirts of Berlin. I think later on they moved to Gatow, near the airport or something. I moved them. Because it was strange to me, because at Spandau Barracks, you only looked a quarter mile down the road, and there was a barbed wire, and there was a Russian section on the other side. And I thought, well, if the balloon went up, there's the Royal Tank Regiment garrison troops with all its armour and everything, and 400 yards down the road is the Russian barrier. I mean, if anything went wrong and they had, I mean, the first thing they'd do was liquidate the garrison tank regiment, because they're only just up the road, you know. But anyway, that's the situation. And in anticipation of them coming, they got a club there, the second time, where they got a club organised. And at the time, it was known as the Churchill Club. But later on, they called it the Beaver Club, because that was one of the squadrons. I think that was the recce squadron of the Royal Tank Regiment. It came to be known as the Beaver Squadron. But anyway, they changed it. But while I was there, it was the Churchill Club, you see. And so when we'd finished his business and all this and the other, he was got his own entertainment laid on in the city. And so he said, you do as you like, see me in the morning at such a time, you see. So, of course, I used to just go up the road to the barracks and stop there the night, you see. And, of course, I met Bill Barnett and Bill Bagley and Denny Wells, three of my old crew, you see. And I don't mean we're meeting Albert Garrett. And so we used to go into, and Benny Branson, who was part of, he was one of our old yeoman blokes. I met old Benny. And, of course, we used the car, you see. We used to come into Berlin in the car, you see, from the barracks. And old Bill Barnett, he was a right lad, he was single, so he was quite a free agent. And again, it was black market, you know. If you got something to barter, then you could get a privilege somehow, you see. And of course, with the girls, I mean, families and that, they were desperate for any situation, like, you know. And old Bill Barnett, he said, how do you fancy a bit of stuff in an old image? I said, well, you had about some bloody married. I said, my wife's expecting a kiddie, because I'd had a lead by then, you see. I said, my wife's expecting a kiddie. So he said, oh. And he said, I've got three keys, he said, here, he said, they're three different flats. I thought, it's typical of Bill. But anyway, that was the situation in Berlin, like you say. And so we came back to Belsen, stay the night. And while we was there, now I don't know how it ended up, but while we was there, it turned up there was somebody, there was a connection. Whether somebody asked him to do a favour, or whether it was somebody he knew, I don't know. But one night he was there and he said, I want you to do a favour. So I said, what's that? He said, I've got a young lady, so I'd like you to take her to the pictures. Now, there was a cinema there, but none of the inmates of the camp were allowed to use it without an escort of a soldier. You know, one of the garrison troops could take a guest. But none of the inmates were allowed to use the cinema unattended. You know, it seems as though they got to be, they still got a sort of a curfew, you know, that they got to be in by a certain time. And outside of that time, the cinema was on, you see, so they wouldn't let them go. And he asked me to take a young lady, which I did, you see. And she said, no, she's a girl, she's only about 18. And she spoke a bit of English. We communicated. That's about it, like, you know. Then I had to see her back to the quarters. And I say it's the only time old Wolfie ever thanked me for anything, you know. And when we left, we brought her back to Brussels with us, whoever she was, and that was it. Never seen her more. Don't know who she was, and I think we brought her back to Brussels. So what he got on the cards there, I don't know. Whether she was a relation, or whether he was doing somebody a favour, or somebody in the honorary camp had asked him to do a favour, but obviously somebody in Brussels would take care of her, you know. And so of course life was going on, and lots of things. I can't quite think of all of the things that we used to get up to. I know we went to one thing where one stage where this soldier, British soldier,